From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines. Here's what's happening. North Korea now telling some diplomats to get out. Then they set a chilling April 10th deadline. North Korea sparking fears that it could trigger a nuclear strike as early as next Wednesday. Kim Jong-un's regime issuing a chilling threat to British diplomats, warning them to get out of North Korea. Alarmingly, the North Korean government said it would not be able to guarantee the safety of embassies after April 10th. Russian diplomats have also been advised to evacuate. Man, it's getting tense. An international team of scientists announced new results pointing to the possible detection of dark matter. They're all excited about that. By sifting through a year and a half of data, scientists have found about 400,000 positrons. That's the antimatter partner particles of electrons that are at the right energy to suggest that they were created when particles of dark matter collided and annihilated each other. Head of the EnterpriseMission.com and our science advisor, Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, what does this all mean to us?
Well, the big problem in cosmology is we seem to be a universe made of matter. As everybody learns in high school, you know, you've got matter and then you've got antimatter, where you have negative protons and positive electrons, which are called positrons. And you can have literal atoms that are the mirror image of the atoms that you and I are composed of and all our Coast family. And when you bring matter and antimatter together, you get an annihilating burst of energy, 100% conversion into gamma rays. It's the only 100% conversion of energy that we know of in mainstream physics. And the big mystery has been why, when the universe was created in the so-called Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago, according to the current estimate, why didn't the matter and antimatter that was created in equal amounts wind up destroying itself, producing flashes of gamma rays so that you and I would not be here to be talking on the radio? And this asymmetry between matter and antimatter has been one of the huge puzzles of physics for the last, 100 years, when cosmic rays were first discovered at the beginning of the last century. Now, this latest result from the space station, from the $2 billion alpha magnetic spectrometer instrument that the last shuttle flight specifically funded by Congress to go up and deliver to the space station a couple years ago, has turned up evidence that this asymmetry actually may not be as profound as we had thought, meaning there could be pockets of antimatter, antimatter planets, antimatter stars, antimatter aliens. I mean, the implications
goes on forever.
Scale.
That's huge. What else is going on in the world of space and science, Richard?
Well, last night we said goodnight to Curiosity, which is our nuclear-powered rover sitting on Mars doing some amazing work for about a month. Mars, if you look at it in any planetarium program, is passing literally behind the sun as seen from Earth. And, of course, the radio signals cannot transmit easily from the spacecraft to Earth or from Earth to the spacecraft. You could get mangled commands, garbled information. So they're basically in a radio silence mode for the next month while Mars moves out from behind the sun. And that, of course, for us conspiracy theorists, you like that segue?
I love it.
opens up the field to all kinds of really cool secret observations that NASA couldn't conduct while the press was leaning over their shoulders and looking at their computer screens metaphorically. Seriously, if in this part of the 21st century, NASA does not have a workaround so it can communicate with another planet when the line of sight between Earth and the planet is obscured by, like, the sun, does that really make sense?
No.
So what are they doing in that month? Well, I am going to be showing tomorrow. By the way, I am in town. I'm just
you're in Los Angeles. Matter of fact, I'm in the Burbank Parade tomorrow, or I would have been there to see you.
Because
I would love to see one of your presentations in total.
Okay, well, at some point, that will come to pass.
Well, that will happen.
I am doing a two-hour presentation on an astonishing piece of of research that we put together, which also involves what Curiosity has found on Mars. We have some photographs, George, that are going to knock your socks off, because there is unmistakably crystal clear, ancient, mangled artifacts left by some civilization on that planet from a long time in the past. The conference is called the Awaken Aware 2013 Time Travel and Other Worlds Conference. It's here at the Embassy Suites Hotel. If people want to know how to get tickets, and there are still tickets available, they can go to awakenaware2013.net. That's awakenaware2013.net. This is sponsored by Project Camelot, good old Carrie Lynn Cassidy.
Is this Glendale now? You're going to be in Glendale?
We're right in Glendale. We're literally up the street.
Yeah.
George, if you take your horse in this parade and you just kind of head east.
Hi-O Silver.
You'll be here. There's a bunch of people. David Wilcock is here. George Green is here. Henry Deacon. The fabled Henry Deacon.
You've got
the
some
deep
great
inside
people.
Inside leaker. Henry.
Well, what time's your presentation?
Mine is at 4 o'clock to 6 tomorrow afternoon. I'm going to be talking about the hyperdimensional physics and the measurements we've done at these ancient archaeological sites all over the world, including Chichen Itza last December, that demonstrate the validity of time travel and alternate timelines. This is something I have never put out in public. We've been quietly accumulating this data. It's really mind-boggling, and even my mind is boggled as I was putting this together, because I realized we'd reached a critical mass. We could say and present in public some stunning implications for what could be happening in the next 5-10 years vis-a-vis what's going on politically in the whole solar system.
I tell you what, if the parade ends and we get out of the festivities on time, I may swing by. Richard, thank you so much. Richard's website, enterprisemission.com. The Federal Aviation Administration has announced that it would delay now previously planned closures for 149 air traffic control towers at small airports around the country. Lawsuits are all over the place, and the FAA says, look, we're going to wait until June 15th now to figure out what we're doing. A lot of those small communities need those small airports. The United Kingdom government should suspend the use of a number of pesticides linked to the deaths of bees, according to a committee of MPs, the members of the Commons Environment Audit Committee, calling for a moratorium on the use of some of these chemicals. Britain has refused to back an EU ban on those chemicals, saying their impact on bees is unclear. Well, that's not what the committee is saying. Fisker Automotive. Most of you probably haven't even heard of that company. A struggling government-backed hybrid sports car maker terminated most of its rank-and-file employees in what sources said was a last-ditch effort to conserve cash and fight off a potential bankruptcy filing. Fisker, which raised $1.2 billion from investors and tapped nearly $200 million from us, government loans, has about $30 million in cash left on hand. Where'd all that money go? About 160 workers fired Friday morning. The National UFO Alert Rating System has been updated, with California, Florida, New York, and Texas moving to a UFO Alert 3 as the highest reporting states during the month of March, filed with the Mutual UFO Network. These reports are all over the place. And a few years ago, a U.S. veteran who served in Iraq told us that he and his buddies would look into the skies with night vision goggles, and he said they saw some very strange things. Well, I did too, when Ed Grimsley took me on top of a hotel roof, and we looked with his third-generation goggles. Ed's on the line with us now. Ed, what's new in the world of spotting UFOs? Hello, Ed?
Hello.
There you go. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
What's new in the world out there?
Oh, boy, there's so much. It's unbelievable. Those guys in Iraq might be the ones that contacted me by email.
They might be. I know
how to do it, and they found a lot of stuff. So
when you took me up there, Ed, I saw, too, as you pointed out, and this Iraqi veteran said that they were seeing things in the skies all over the place. You're still looking with these third-generation night vision goggles. Are you still seeing a lot of strange things?
I'm seeing a lot, an awful lot. And there's even new things going on. A fellow down in Florida bought two pair from me, and Chris Barnes, his name, and anybody who wants to ask him is welcome to contact him. He's rankloxon.com, and he does websites and that kind of thing. He's just a super guy, and he's going out, and we've been advising and talking and discussing how to do and what, and he's gotten real good at it, and he's finding pyramid-shaped golden
type.
And they're flying, and there's several of them coming in, and there's a place in Florida at a lake, and he calls me and talks to me about it while it's going on and at it. And it's just awesome. These things come in, and they slow up, they come to a stop, and they let smaller ones out.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, Ed. And I didn't believe you until you took me up there to look at these strange objects. They're out there. If any of you want to take a look at some of the things that Ed does, his website is edgrimsley.com. It's part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. In a moment, who was Dracula? Jim Steinmeier joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Jim Steinmeier. Now, he's worked with well-known magicians developing material and creating special effects for shows, but Jim is also well-versed on the history of magic. He's a noted author. We're going to talk about Who Was Dracula, Bram Stoker's Trail of Blood. Jim, how'd you get into this one?
Well, that's an interesting story, isn't it? I've always been a fan, I think, of the stories. It was a book that I read when I was a boy. It was the first adult novel I read, which meant, I suppose, that I had to go to the adult section of the library when I was 8 or 9, and I slogged through, 400 pages without a picture in it. And it certainly left a strong impression on me, and, of course, the movies as well. And then sometime in the 1980s, I had a chance to work with Orson Welles, and he was also fascinated by Dracula. And he was the first person that said to me the theory that Dracula was actually Henry Irving, and he thought that was particularly interesting.
Yeah.
Because Henry Irving was Bram Stoker's boss. And I know now where Orson got that theory, where he had read that, and why he picked that up from the theater world.
And he truly believed it, or was he trying to kid?
No, he did believe it. He thought it was quite funny, and it was the inside joke is that the character was based on Stoker's boss. The story is more complicated than that. I think that's now clear. I think Orson would have been delighted to have had the full story. Certainly, Irving was part of the formula, but there were a number of really famous big personalities that highly influenced that book. And so I've always followed the story, and I've always been a fan of the twists and turns, and particularly kind of the backstage story. And because I've done work on stage in the theater, designing effects, I've always been interested in Stoker's connection to the theater, because that's really how he was known in Victorian London. He was known as the manager of the Lyceum Theater. That's why he was a celebrity, not necessarily for his novels.
Now, how did you decide to investigate the origins of all of this?
There's really fascinating material out there, and there's been fantastic stuff written about this over the years. Some great authors like Elizabeth Miller and David Scall have been turning over fantastic Dracula material.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also great information out there. In the late 1970s, Stoker's notes for composing the novel were discovered, and that really changed everything. Those are in a private library in Philadelphia, and that surprised everyone as to how this novel was composed, and it made everybody rewrite the histories. And I think that what's key inside of those novels are also keys to how he structured the story around personalities and events at the time. In the introduction of the book, I write about some of the personalities, and I say, is it possible that these people influenced the story? And I think that when you really see who he was dealing with and what the scandals that he was in the middle of, you have to ask, is it possible that they didn't influence the story? Because they were so prevalent in London, and they were so much part of Bram Stoker's world, that he naturally worked these incidents and these people into his story.
Was he a historian of Dracula, or was he creating this in his head?
Well, now the big myth to disabuse, which is the Vlad Tepes myth, you know, the famous historical Dracula, the Wallachian count from the 15th century. Stoker was a meticulous researcher. And when his notes were discovered, what people discovered was a full list of the books that he used as sources. So, of course, we can go back and see exactly what he started with. And, in fact, he did find the name of this count, who was nicknamed Dracul, which means of the devil or of the dragon.
That was Vlad, right?
Vlad, yeah. Yes.
He was real.
He was a real count who, in later books, had a number of horrible things attributed to him, that he tortured people, that he impaled people on spikes, that
yes.
he threatened his enemies with this. But this turned out to be a huge literary red herring. In fact, the authors who wrote that book, In Search of Dracula, they did an amazing job, McNally and Florescu. They did amazing research. But they were also the ones that later discovered the notes, and what they found is they were wrong about their assumption. All Bram Stoker had was the name Dracula and the fact that he was a ruler in that area at a certain time. The rest of it was completely made up. He had no sense of the horrors attributed to this man. That was all happenstance.
And the Vlad, apparently, part of the reason he would impale heads, for example, on mm-hmm. spikes, is he wanted his enemies to say, whoa, we're not going to fool around with this guy.
That's right. He was a very serious and bloodthirsty ruler in the days when you could do that. And he used those tortures to dissuade his enemies. There's the one incident, which might be partly legend, but certainly is probably founded in some truth, is that he surrounded his castle with the bodies of his enemies so that when the approaching armies
saw that,
they turned around and left. So the irony of the story is that the name happened to be a perfect name. When Stoker started the novel, he was using the name Wampir. Not a very clever name, and it's hard to imagine that might have caught on. But he was sort of using that as a placeholder when he started the novel. And at some point during his research, he found the name Dracula.
Where did the stake through the heart, garlic to protect you, a church, you know, the crucifix, was that Hollywood?
No. That's Stoker. And one of the wonderful things that he did for us is formalize all of that. He really wrote the rules of the vampire. Now, many of those were taken, and again, we can consult his sources. We can see that many of those were taken from books about superstition of Middle Europe. But of course, a lot of those books, you know, the rules slightly differ, the rules are vague, the rules are vaguely written. So Stoker was the one who basically gathered the rules that he wanted to use and then formalized them and put him in his book. And of course, he has this wonderful character, Van Helsing, who's the professor. So, of course, when Van Helsing goes through the rules and says, this is what we must know, it's official, and it sounds official in the book. But it was really Bram Stoker who decided that he had to have a series of rules for this vampire. And since then, we've been using all those rules. Now, as part of that, he invented some of his own rules, and he let Dracula play with some of those rules. And that's created some controversy and some problems within the book itself. But it's interesting that that's really something he needs to be credited with, is that he basically defined the vampire for us.
The thoughts of Jack the Ripper, any tie-in to vampires and Dracula?
Well, absolutely. I write about the four people that I say were huge influences on this book, which were Henry Irving, Walt Whitman, the poet.
The poet, yeah.
Yeah, Oscar Wilde, who was a childhood friend and knew Stoker very well in London. And Jack the Ripper. He credited Jack the Ripper in an introduction to Dracula, a later introduction to Dracula. He mentioned the Ripper crimes as being inspirations for this. And clearly that whole crime spree, which was just several years before he started composing the book, must have weighed heavily on his mind. What's interesting about it is that what we've now found in recent years is that he very well might have known the primary suspect in that case, Scotland Yard's primary suspect.
Really? Okay.
Yes. He was an American named Francis Tumulty, and it's well documented that the head of Scotland Yard considered him the prime suspect.
He was a cardiologist, wasn't he?
He was. I think you're giving him too much credit. He was a quack.
He died in St. Louis.
He did die in St. Louis. You're absolutely right. That's him. He might have claimed to be a cardiac.
I may have known the guy in another life, for all I know.
You might have been treated by him. He died in St. Louis. He skipped out on bail.
Hold on for 1 second, Jimmy. We're going to come right back and talk more about who was Dracula. We'll be back in a moment. And we're talking with Jim Steinmeier, who was Dracula. We'll take calls with Jim next hour before we get into open lines here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Jim. Even though we're talking about Dracula, I do want to get your take again on the Jack the Vampire possible suspect. I guess Tumblety, when he was in London, he was arrested as a suspect, wasn't he?
He was picked up in a sweep of that area because there was a lot of police activity because of the Jack the Ripper murders. He was arrested on a different charge, however. He was actually arrested on a morals charge, and it's not exactly clear what that case was, but it was something expedient to get him into jail. And when he was in jail, a friend posted bail, and then he skipped bail. He went to France and then sailed very quickly to the United States.
And ended up in St. Louis.
He ended up in a roundabout way. He was in New York for quite a while and then ended up working his way to St. Louis. And the extradition, there just weren't, because of the charge he was picked up on, there weren't provisions to extradite him on that. But he was watched very carefully in New York. And years later, one of the lead investigators in that case wrote in a private papers that he considered him always the lead suspect.
I think a couple guys from Scotland Yard, if I remember, I had them on my show.
They actually came over
yeah.
In an effort to get him. Yes, that's right.
They thought he was the one.
Right. And he was, every one of your listeners who's read a copy of Dracula has turned past the page in which the book is dedicated to Hami Beg. And that's what it says, to Hami Beg.
Now, who's that?
Hami Beg was a very good friend of Bram Stoker's, a Victorian novelist named Hall Caine.
Okay.
Very popular. And that was his nickname. It was his Manx nickname, Hami Beg. And Hami Beg was a friend of Tumblety. And there's every reason to believe that because of that, that Stoker met Tumblety years later.
I wonder if any more murders occurred in St. Louis when he came back.
It wouldn't have been St. Louis was quite at the end of his life.
It was, okay.
Yeah, but certainly the suspicion in London was that the murders stopped after he left.
And as we know, there are no coincidences.
Well, the police chief pointed out that coincidence. And when he was questioned, when Tumblety was questioned back in New York about all of this, he insisted that he was a man of good standing, and he pointed out that he had been invited to the Beefsteak Club. Well, if you try and put that all together, that very well might mean that he had dinner with Bram Stoker at the Lyceum Theater. The Beefsteak Room was a little room at the theater in which Stoker and Henry Irving, the actor, invited special guests.
Ah, okay.
And so it's interesting to speculate. It doesn't take too much speculation to see, because of their mutual friend, that Stoker and Jack the Ripper might well have shared dinner and had an interesting conversation. Obviously, Jack didn't confess his crimes, and I'm not so sure if at that time Bram Stoker confessed his plans for a book, but certainly he was influenced heavily by the crime spree at the time and was also heavily influenced in his professional career because another play that was at the theater at that time was criticized because of its tie to violence. It was a production of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Where did the bloodsucker of vampire come in?
Well, the vampire, you know, Stoker should be given credit for doing a very commercial book. There were vampire novels before him. There were vampire plays before him. And he was in a position professionally to know what a success those were. He knew people who wrote those books, and he had a chance to talk to them. And he knew, for example, that a play called The Vampire by Dion Boucicault, an Irish playwright, was always a big success. So I think that Stoker, number one, cobbled his story together from other vampire stories. But he was a very clever researcher, and he did research on Middle European folklore. And he combined all of that in his book. And then he put together these myths and formalized them all about the blood-sucking. For example, the Stoker's invention was how a vampire is created. that if you die by a vampire's bite, you'll become a vampire. That wasn't formalized before his time. That was something that was invented for Dracula, and now, of course, has worked its way right into the literature. And, of course, it completely changed the novel. It changed the nature of the novel. It changed the nature of the chase and the characters. And I think it also tied to what he was thinking about, some of the controversies of the day of people that he knew, that kind of pestilence that was happening through London.
Did Stoker make any money on his Dracula novel?
That's a good question. He certainly made money on it. It was his most successful book. Bram Stoker wrote a number of novels through his professional career. Many of them, most of them, were dashed off kind of hurriedly, and they didn't last. They show that quality. Dracula, everyone was surprised to find that Dracula was composed over a seven-year period. It was very, very carefully written, and it was certainly his most successful book in his lifetime, by far. However, Stoker never lived to understand how successful it was. I think at the time of his death, in 1912, he just understood that it was his most successful book. It was a good book. It got good to moderate reviews, but it was really after his death, when the West End came calling, when Broadway came calling, and when Hollywood came calling, that Dracula became a cultural success.
Well, you know, it's amazing. Had he lived and saw movies coming and everything else, he would have been in shock, Jim.
Oh, I think he would have been. He aspired to be a good writer, and he always worked throughout his career. He certainly had clear aspirations as a writer. I think he would have been delighted to have seen the success of this character. And also, as a man of the theater, he did definitely try to put Dracula on stage. There's no doubt about it that one of his intentions in writing this book was to see it realized as a stage play. And he didn't have that realized during his lifetime. But I think he would have been really delighted and surprised to see how durable this character was and how it's changed over the years.
How did Bela Lugosi pop up for his movie parts?
Well, Lugosi was working in the United States as an actor. And at the time that he was cast in the Broadway version.
And he was like a 2 cents actor, wasn't he?
He had some success on Broadway, but he knew very little English. The part of Dracula he learned phonetically for the Broadway show, and he didn't fully understand what he was saying, actually, but he was perfect for the part. One of the most amazing things about the novel is that the character is very badly defined in the novel, and I don't know if that's Stoker being a genius or Stoker being careless, but it certainly worked to his advantage, because every generation we get to reinvent Dracula. And I think the first evidence you see of this is 1926, 1927, when the role goes to Bela Lugosi. Bela Lugosi doesn't look anything like the Dracula that's described in the book, but who Bela Lugosi looks like is he looks like Rudolph Valentino.
Was the vampire in the book more like Nosferatu,
he's
hideous-looking creature?
Yes, he's a kind of dissolute old man with a long white mustache and long white hair and bad breath and pointed teeth.
Yeah, what were you? You suck on somebody's neck. You see what your breath tastes like.
That's right. But of course, when he becomes Lugosi, he becomes a kind of leading man. You know, he becomes a kind of creepy version of a Valentino Latin lover with the patent leather hair. And he really becomes, you know, the kind of foreign man who comes over to steal our women. I mean, that's sort of the way that role is portrayed.
Right.
And so that really dusted off Dracula, no pun intended. Dusted off Dracula for a new generation for the 1920s. And, of course, every generation after that, we reinvent Dracula again and again and again.
And he becomes more romantic, doesn't he?
He? Of course, there's always a romantic element associated with him. There is a kind of strange romantic element associated with him in the original novel as well, even though he's not a romantic figure. Mina, the leading lady, comes to feel sorry for him and comes to pity him, and we see that there's an attraction there. But, you know, today he's a teenager, and that works perfectly well, too, in the Twilight
Zone. Well, that's because they're going to the movies, I guess. Right. They're spending money.
But it's perfect that teenagers are, you know, involved in immortality and, you know, lust and all those things that teenagers aren't supposed to talk about, they can talk about with vampires.
What about the craze, though, nowadays, Jim? You know, people going to dentists to get, you know, vampire fangs put in permanently, things like that.
I think one of the amazing things about this character and this role is that it has been hotwired directly into popular culture that way. And I think that's one thing that Stoker never would have seen. There's something about I think the vampire story, You know, previous to this kind of literature, you talked about subjects like immortality and morality and life and death in big, important terms. You know, the priests talked to you about that. The Bible talked to you about that. You talked to church elders about those subjects. And with Dracula, that's a kind of popular literature back way into all these subjects. You get to talk about all those important subjects, and there's this kind of dangerous, wonderful fiction associated with it. And I think the appeal is just the same appeal that those subjects have always had, but there's also a kind of pop culture way of dealing with it now.
Why do people like to get scared, Jim? They like it.
I think it's like people getting on roller coasters, you know. I think it's a sort of natural high.
It's a rush, isn't it?
It really is a rush, and I think you can see that, you know, even though it's a late Victorian novel, you can see that in Bram Stoker's novel as well. There are incidents that in the middle of this kind of very slow moving book, there are incidents in the middle of it that just jolted into action, and there are times when you turn the page, and it's very hard to believe you're reading a novel from the 1890s. You know, something so sudden, so unexpected, so graphic. And not all of those things translated into the films. Some of those are still surprises in the book.
When you were doing your book, Who Was Dracula? Were you, I mean, they're all out there. Anne Rice's series, yeah. Everybody else. Yeah. Was Stoker's number one on your mind?
Well, I would say Stoker's was number one on my mind, because what I'm actually writing about is, of course, Stoker himself and how that book was composed. But it's very interesting. It's very interesting when you mentioned Anne Rice, because, again, that's another kind of pivot on the Dracula story. And one of the things that Anne Rice, I think, did so brilliantly in that book, she just adopts exactly the opposite point of view of Dracula. Dracula is a book of just about 400 pages, and Dracula appears on just about 60 of those pages. And very often, that's in the form of a bat or a wolf. He has only a few speeches. The book is all written as a series of letters and diary entries. So it's all first person. People talk all first person. Here's what happened to me. Here's what I was thinking. Except Dracula. Dracula is always described by somebody else. And so as the book progresses, he becomes less and less of a person. He becomes vaguer. We know him less as the book goes on. Anne Rice did an amazing thing with Diary of a Vampire, which is that she basically told the story from the vampire's point of view.
Yeah, exactly.
She took the kind of Dracula aspect of this and for the first time kind of said, well, here's what the vampire thinks. Here's what the vampire thinks about as he's draining blood out of somebody. Here's what the vampire thinks about immortality. And that was the point of view that we never got from Dracula himself. So it sort of completed the missing part of that picture.
Frankenstein, written by Mary Shelley around, what, 1818, something like that?
Frankenstein is a much, much older book. Absolutely, yeah. Yes. Yeah, the early Victorian book. Yes.
Okay. Came way before even Stoker was born.
Yes, exactly. And it's funny that we lumped them all together today, but they're really written at different times in the Victorian era and really composed from very different points of view. I think really Stoker's greatest compliments were people comparing the book to Frankenstein. His mother was thrilled by the book. She was an older lady at the time she read it, but she understood instantly that her son had done something of importance, and she compared it to Frankenstein.
I remember that era when I was into Frankenstein, Dracula, the Wolfman. You remember that? He came later, didn't he?
The Wolfman was a kind of creation of Hollywood to put those stories, to put those kind of vague werewolf stories into print. The Mummy story was suggested by a Stoker story, by one of his later novels. But he didn't write very many horror stories, Stoker himself. His other novels were generally kind of like travelogue novels. They were told about exotic places.
And his Dracula book, was it a series or just a one-time book?
No, it was a one-time book. It was published as a one-time book, and it was not serialized. Not before it came out, it wasn't serialized. And it really struck everybody. It surprised everybody who knew him. I think that's the best way to say it. Bram Stoker was a solid citizen. He was a minor celebrity in London because he ran Henry Irving's theater. He was known by all of society. And when they read this kind of horrific book, about the undead and about blood and lust. And they all kind of said, you know, that was Bram Stoker who wrote that, because he was such a genial, friendly fellow. You know, his official job was to run that theater and to be nice to everyone who came through the door and to escort the celebrities around and invite them to dinner with Henry Irving. And so I think everyone was shocked that a man like that could actually come up with a horror like that.
That's amazing. It's amazing at how it all just evolved and changed over the years. Where does it go next? I mean, what do you do after the romantic Twilight series? What's next?
Well,
do they bury Dracula once and for all?
I don't think, you know, it's really interesting. One of the book has, Stoker's book has several problems with it. There are several flaws in the book, and one of the flaws is that after defining exactly how you have to kill a vampire, he doesn't kill him that way. And some writers have speculated that Bram Stoker was the first guy who, you know, built in the extra clause that Hollywood used to do, you know, where they would do Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, and then a few years later they could find both monsters alive again because of some technicality. You know, they didn't actually die. I think actually that the end of Dracula was a mistake on Bram Stoker's part. And by the time he got to the end of that book, he had actually forgotten the rules that he'd created. Mm-hmm. But I think that to answer your question, I think that every generation will find a new way of reviving this character. We say what's next for Dracula. I think we kind of say what's next for us. You know, what's popular culture? Who are the appealing stars going to be 20 years from now, 30 years from now? And I think it's very easy to say that all we're going to do is pivot off of those people. Just like we said Rudolph Valentino, like we say, you know, pop stars of today. We pivot off of those people, and then we apply these stories of immortality and the undead, the kind of dark side, and we apply those to those popular stars, and instantly those stories are dusted off for a new generation.
The people who now literally practice vampirism, are they particularly nuts? Are they nice people? What's going on here?
The people that I've seen interviews with who practice vampirism I think it's a psychological condition, you know, that's a real feeling that they need to have blood. They're certainly not, they don't say that they're murderers, but they say that they are people who feel a need to actually ingest blood. And I think it's a psychological condition, but I think it's also tied into a kind of mania for this, for these myths. It's an understanding of these myths on a deeply personal level, and it's something that's affected them in some way. So I think, you know, there through history, and Stoker had to deal with this as well, there have been many, many quote-unquote vampires in the sense that there have been crimes attributed to vampires in superstition. I don't think there are people who really claim that there are vampires today, literal vampires in human form today. But it's something that will never quite go away because it's always been tied very closely to our myths.
Dramatic. Where do we get your book, Who Was Dracula?
It's available on Amazon and in bookstores everywhere. It's published by Penguin.
Did you have fun writing this?
It was great fun. It was great fun, and it's great fun. The historical figures that walk through the door and who knew Bram Stoker are amazing, Oscar Wilde and Walt Whitman and Henry Irving. They were huge personalities, and they were involved in big scandals, Victorian scandals. So it's a great period of time to write about, and it was a lot of fun.
Let's talk a little bit about magic next hour, Jim, and take some calls, okay? Jim Steinmeier, he's also written several books about magic as well, but we're going to open up the phone lines. We'll give you an opportunity to chat with him about magic, which we'll talk about very briefly when we come back, and, of course, Dracula. Who was Dracula? And if you're into Dracula, I mean, if you got your fangs put in by a dentist, check in with us as well. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.